Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, five planets come into view for sky watchers, and the weird science of dog origins, and more. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Well, the moon is a very convenient guide to objects in the sky. So around the 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th, the moon, the waxing crescent moon, is going to sweep past them, and it'll give you a good opportunity to see those planets.
That's skywatcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, science news of the week with Emily Howard and Chris Comfort.
Broad Group, a construction company in China, has announced it will build the world's tallest skyscraper in just 90 days. Plus, they say, Sky City 1 will be much cheaper to build than the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, which is currently the world's tallest man-made structure. The reason? About 95% of Sky City 1 will be put together in modular form before work commences on-site. Government approval is pending, but Broad Group says it can have the skyscraper up by early 2013.
NOAA and the National Climatic Data Center have released the monthly temperature stats for May 2012. They say that globally, the combined land and ocean average surface temperature last month made May 2012 the second warmest May since record-keeping began in 1880.
The historic Rio Plus 20 conference in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, occurred this past week. It brought together thousands of government, business, academic, and NGO leaders to renew global commitments to sustainable development, assess the progress made to date, and address new and emerging issues. Officials identified seven issues critical to ensuring human sustainability on Earth in the 21st century. They are jobs, energy, cities, food, water, oceans, and disaster response.
An international team of scientists released an analysis of the global risk of wildfires in a warming world in early June 2012. It suggests that by the end of the 21st century, almost all of North America and most of Europe could see a jump in the frequency of wildfires, primarily because of increasing temperatures. At the same time, fire activity could decrease around equatorial regions, particularly among the tropical rainforests.
Last week, we celebrated the summer solstice in the northern hemisphere and the winter solstice in the southern hemisphere. This week, all of planet Earth will be farthest from the sun. Happy Earthophelion, everyone. That's our news of the week. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Chris Comfort. Our song of the week is Are You a Mirror by Quiet Company.
Oh, little baby, you are fragile and weak. So I will hold you till you fall asleep. I look inside you and I see myself. I look inside you and I see myself. So I will love you, I will try and be strong. But my bones are aching and my days are long. You'll look inside me and you'll see yourself. You'll look inside me.
Inside you and I see myself.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here with news of the global night sky. Five planets come into view. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. So three of these planets are in the evening sky and two are in the morning sky. So let's start with the two easy ones, the two brightest planets, Venus and Jupiter. The tough thing about it for the Northern Hemisphere is that they're up before dawn. And of course, it's summer, so dawn's coming pretty early. But if you're up before dawn, look in the eastern sky, low in the east, before the sun comes up, and you'll be treated to this beautiful view of the two brightest planets, Venus and Jupiter, pretty close to the horizon in the east before sunup.
Awesome. Venus and Jupiter in the morning. Can anyone see this on Earth?
Everything I'm about to say here mostly applies to both hemispheres. So yes, you can see Venus and Jupiter from all over the Earth now.
Awesome. And what else?
So in the evening sky, there are three planets. And in fact, there are only five planets easily visible to the eye, Jorge. So these five planets we're talking about here are the ones. So Venus and Jupiter up before dawn. In the evening sky are the other three visible planets, Mercury, Mars, and Saturn. So Mercury right now is about equally visible from both hemispheres. It's about the same distance above the horizon after sunset from both hemispheres. It's a little easier to find from the northern hemisphere just because of the orientation with respect to other stars. From the northern hemisphere, there you'll actually see three bright objects low in the western sky after sunset now. The brightest one of those, the one on the far left, is Mercury. From the southern hemisphere, it's pretty much the same thing, except two of those three objects are aimed downward toward the horizon. So they're pretty much below the horizon when you see Mercury above it. So from the southern hemisphere, you'll just see lone Mercury shining very close to the horizon after sunset. And no matter where you are, Mercury will be surprisingly bright for being so low in the sky.
That's amazing. I mean, we don't usually get a chance to see Mercury, do we?
Well, Mercury is actually a pretty bright planet, and some people think we don't see it because it's not very bright. But in fact, it's pretty bright. It's brighter, as bright as the brightest stars. The two stars that it's next to, as seen from the northern hemisphere right now, are Castor and Pollux, the two brightest stars in the constellation Gemini the Twins. They're considered to be two of the brightest stars in the sky, and Mercury is a little bit brighter than either one of those. So Mercury is a pretty bright planet, not as bright as Venus and Jupiter, but pretty bright and visible low in the west after sunset from both hemispheres now.
And what about these other two planets that you mentioned?
Well, so the other two are Mars and Saturn. And normally I wouldn't try to just point those out to you on the radio like this because they're as bright as the brightest stars, but there's a lot of stars up there. So it's, not so easy always to pick them out. But it just so happens that this week around the 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th, the moon is going to be in the same part of the sky as Mars and Saturn. So Mars and Saturn are relatively close to each other now on the sky's dome. The moon, the waxing crescent moon, is going to sweep past them, and it'll give you a good opportunity to see those planets.
Yeah, there's few things just more beautiful than seeing the waxing or a crescent moon near these planets, these stars.
Well, the moon is a very convenient guide to objects in the sky. So around the 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th, one thing you can do is come to earthsky.org, and we'll definitely have charts of these planets in the night sky that'll help you, tell which one is Mars and which one is Saturn, and you can find some planets.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Today, we welcome back Ryan Britton for another foray into the world of weird science. Welcome back, Ryan.
Hi, Jorge. How are you?
Doing great. So today's story is about dogs.
That's right. Man's best friend.
Right. So dogs are all around us, and I understand how they evolved into man's best friend is somewhat of a mystery.
It is a mystery. The consensus in the science community is that dogs evolved from wolves. And that happened sometime between 15,000 years ago and 100,000 years ago. Now, that estimate is pretty broad, and it has to do a lot with humanity. And this is according to a study by the University of Durham in England. So humanity has bred dogs and crossbred dogs for all kinds of things. Guard dogs, hunting dogs, dogs that are just, you know, fun to pet and play with. And what's happened is their genetics are so jumbled up that scientists at the University of Durham could not trace genetic lines more than a couple hundred years. We can't trace the history of the dog. Well, you know, not yet anyway.
Ryan, aren't some dog breeds supposed to be really old and breeds that have been around for a while?
Right. There are some breeds that are called ancient breeds.
Okay. What about those?
But even those breeds, DNA has been found from other parts of the world and not in the part of the world where the dog is thought to have been bred in. So, for instance, the Basenji in China. Not all of its DNA is from China. So again, it's a jumble of breeding and locations. You know, the study boils down to this. According to scientists, we're probably not going to get any closer to understanding how the modern dog originated, how the modern dog evolved, by studying modern breeds.
It kind of goes against the thinking of a pure breed. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, all dogs are mutts.
Yeah, in that sense, that's correct.
And what's next?
Well, we'll have to dig some up. And this is sort of another weird part of the story, is that this is according to Adam Boyko of Cornell University. So he's quoted in the New York Times. Dr. Boyko says, "We're fortunate in that humans have been burying dogs for a long time. And there's DNA there, so we just need to find some of these more ancient dogs and dig them up."
Where can people listening dig up more information about this?
Well, there's a more detailed summary at the New York Times at nytimes.com. And the study can be found in the academic journal called The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and that's at pnas.org.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. A new radio telescope based in the Netherlands is set to begin its first low-frequency survey of the sky. It's called LOFAR, short for Low Frequency Array, and it will search for the first stars and black holes in the universe, as well as investigate a period of the early universe called the Epoch of Reionization, just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. Gerda Braun is a senior scientist at the Institute for Radio Astronomy in the Netherlands, and he's a principal investigator for the LOFAR telescope. He spoke with Earth Sky in Austin, Texas, early 2012 at the 219th meeting of the American Astronomical Society. Dr. De Braun, welcome.
Thank you. So tell us about this LOFAR telescope.
Okay, well, LOFAR is an array of very simple dipoles like you might have had on your roof in the past to receive television or radio. And we've deployed thousands, even tens of thousands of these dipoles in clusters together to pick up signals from the universe. And this concept has been so useful that we have grown to become an international telescope, LOFAR, with stations in Sweden, in France, in England, and in Germany, as well as most of the stations which are in the Netherlands. And so it's a telescope that works at low frequencies, and resolution of a telescope is limited by the wavelength, so you have to actually have a big telescope to make fine, sharp images. So that's what LOFAR can do. But LOFAR can do incredible number of things. It can look at multiple directions in the sky at the same time. So it can form beams in 3 up to 10, 20 different directions, just as much as your computers can handle. And so it's a very versatile telescope, and the scientific applications are unlimited.
Tell us about how you are involved with this LOFAR telescope, looking at the early days of the universe, just 400, 800 million years, a relatively short time after the Big Bang.
A short history of the universe is that after the Big Bang, after 500,000 years, the universe recombined. So it started out very hot, it recombined, and then most of the gas in the universe was neutral hydrogen. Called neutral hydrogen, got colder all the time when the universe expanded. But we know, we're here today, we see stars around us, galaxies around us, that there must have been a phase when stars were formed, when the universe actually re-ionized again, because we don't see all that neutral hydrogen anymore. It's all ionized. Now, we have some constraints on when that actually happened, so limits on when it happened. It must have happened before the redshift of 6. And redshift of 6 corresponds to a time of about 1 billion years after the Big Bang, 0.8 billion years, I think. And so we think that between 0.4 and 0.8 billion years after the Big Bang, the first stars and galaxies and quasars started to re-ionize the neutral hydrogen in the universe. And we want to know a lot of things. We have a lot of questions about how that process happened. How massive were these first stars, how many ionizing photons they produced. So we just want to know when it happened, how it happened, and who did it. Was it the stars, was it the galaxies, was it the black holes?
Tell us a little bit more about this epoch of reionization.
So we have two important phases after the Big Bang, which scientists study, which astronomers study. One is this, the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, which came from the recombination of the gas in the early universe. It happened only 500,000 years. But then for 400 million years, nothing happened. And then the second phase, reionization, which destroyed all these neutral hydrogen atoms anymore again. And so we have this first phase happening at 500,000 years, which was studied by WMAP, by all these telescopes, Planck right now, taking images of this very early phase, this cosmic afterglow. We're studying the structure in the neutral hydrogen of certain phases in the universe. So where is the neutral hydrogen? Where is it gone? Where is it destroyed? And so, and we know that there's very few methods of actually ionizing hydrogen. It requires photons, ionizing photons. And so that is the link with the first stars and the first quasars. So indirectly, we're not going to see the first stars directly because they're too faint. I mean, only you might need James Webb Space Telescope, the one that will go up in 2018, to actually start seeing perhaps the first galaxies themselves, the light from those galaxies. What we're seeing is the fact that these galaxies were there and destroyed the neutral hydrogen around them. And we can do that very sensitively with our LOFAR telescope.
You've been listening to Dutch astronomer Ger de Bron. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us.
What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't. Of the next stage. What you don't know won't have you terrified.